dripping blood. A thin black line ran through the name, scratching it out. The name was Chadwick. Sophie's breath caught. In a single mark, a soul lost. For a long while no one spoke, the silence broken only by the festive buzz behind them and the snores of sleeping stimps overhead, perched on the scaffolding shrouding the schoolmaster's tower. Dot wiped her eyes, while Anadil focused on the ground. Even Hester looked unsteady. Gazing across the lake at Good's glass castle, Sophie thought of the burly, grey-eyed Everboy who'd once swaggered down those halls and been Tedros's most faithful liege, just like Agatha had been her own. But Agatha was still alive, of course, even if she was somewhere far away. Tedros's best friend was dead.
How?
Sophie stammered.
We don't know, said Professor Dovey emptily. His body must be in Avalon. Otherwise, his figure would have moved on the map.
Avalon, Sophie remembered. On her quest map, she'd seen Chadwick's figurine there when he should have been off seeking new knights for Tedros's kingdom. What was Chadwick doing alone in Avalon, which was perpetually cold and uninhabited? It's not like he could get into the Lady of the Lake's castle. Only Merlin or the King of Camelot could do that. And yet, she distinctly remembered seeing Chadwick's figurine inside the castle gates. Still, even if he did get in somehow, wouldn't the Lady of the Lake have protected him? Chadwick was Camelot's knight. Dovey's voice severed her thoughts.
He sent me a note by Crow a couple weeks ago. He'd been hearing reports of attacks in the woods and wanted to find out who was behind them. I ordered him not to make a move, to stay on his original mission. Clearly, he disobeyed.
Sophie looked at her.
Whatever he found must have gotten him killed,
the dean said quietly.
And now you want me to go and get killed too?
Sophie asked.
Unlike Chadwick, you will have friends at your side,
the dean replied, eyeing the three witches.
There's that word friends again,
Hester murmured. Dovey ignored her.
I'd been looking into the news of attacks long before Chadwick wrote. The moment students' names started turning red on my map, I'd asked Merlin to investigate. It's common for students' quests to go badly at first. We've certainly dispatched rescue teams before. But for all to be failing was unprecedented. At the same time, we'd been hearing reports of unrest in the woods, prompted by seemingly random crimes against Evers and Nevers alike. And then there was the matter of Tedros's sword, stuck in that stone. I thought Merlin could get to the bottom of all this. Well, a few days ago, he finally returned to my chambers. He asked only one question. What fairy tale had the Storian been writing?
Nothing of substance. I've told you that, Sophie said, glancing up at the schoolmaster's tower, now her private quarters, which was connected to Evil's castle by a catwalk. She saw the Storian through the window, hovering over a stone table littered with crumpled paper.
Ever since it finished mine and Agatha's fairy tale, it's been starting and discarding tales of our classmates' quests. And whose story is it working on now?
Said Dovey.
It stopped writing completely last week, which, after all that frantic scribbling and crumpling the past few months, is actually letting me sleep.
Sophie puffed.
But you said that the story an often suspects a fairy tale will be a good one, only to scrap it mid-story. That it's perfectly normal. To a point,
Professor Dovey replied.
The Storian only writes tales that we need, stories that will redress a balance between good and evil that is constantly in flux. But 6 months is a long time for the Storian not to put a new tale into the woods. Perhaps it sees no story in your classmates' failing quests worth telling. Merlin, however, believes all these failures are connected, and that there is a bigger quest waiting to be undertaken, that this is the fairy tale the Storian needs to tell. Yet you have no proof of this bigger quest or fairy tale, said Sophie.
And yet we still have to go with her,
Hester said, leering at Sophie.
A student is dead, girls. I'd think at the very least you'd want to bury his body, let alone find out what killed him, said Professor Dovey frostily.
I do.
Sophie and the witches fell silent.
There is also the fact that, according to the map, you are all failing your quests, too,
Professor Dovey said. Sophie and the coven gawked at her before swiveling to the map. They'd been so focused on their classmates that they hadn't noticed their own names were in red.
How can I be failing? Sophie protested. My quest is to be Dean of Evil. That's the quest Lady Lesso gave me.
And how could we be failing? Said Hester, looking at her witch friends. We didn't do anything wrong on our quest.
Unless, of course, your quests no longer apply, said Professor Dovey.
Sophie and the witches exchanged confused looks.
You see, your names only turned red on my map yesterday, within minutes of Chaddock's death, said Professor Dovey. I highly doubt it's a coincidence. The Storian creates a quest map every 3 years once the new class goes into the woods. The fact the pen has stopped writing, combined with your names turning red, only strengthened Merlin's and my conclusion that a new, more important quest awaits each of you. Only then will the Storian begin its next tale.
She paused, expecting questions, but Sophie and the witches still looked dazed.
If it was up to me, Merlin and I would go into the woods ourselves, Dovey went on. The teachers cannot directly interfere with a student's quest, just as we cannot interfere in a fairy tale. Which means you will represent the Nevers on this new quest, and Merlin will be sending an Ever contingent tonight to join your team. Given Chaddock's demise, all of this was too sensitive to be transmitted in any way other than in person. So that's why I brought you back to school. You must leave as soon as possible to prevent more casualties. But you're not just a rescue team. You're a detective team. Something out there is hurting our students, and your new quest is to find it. One quest to save them all.
Sophie couldn't focus, a single thought haunting her.
Has anyone told Tedros about...
No, Professor Dovey answered, rising from her seat.
Telling Tedros will surely lead to him doing something rash, especially since we've yet to learn how his friend died. The island of Avalon, then, should be the first stop on your new quest. Even if you can't get through the castle's gates, you might find clues as to what Chaddock was doing there.
Sophie's mind went gauzy,
as if she was trying to wake from a dream. Dead friends? Bodies to be buried? A mysterious threat? How quickly things change in a fairy tale. A few minutes ago, she was the host of a rollicking party that finally helped her turn the page and begin a new chapter. But now she was facing a new quest far away from school, where her life would be as much at risk as the friends' lives she had to save. Only she wasn't ready to leave this place. After 3 years, she'd found her way out of a fairy tale and wouldn't let herself be dragged back into one. And the best part about being evil was that she could admit this without guilt. The new and improved Sophie could accept the selfish shades of her soul as much as the generous ones. Which meant that no matter how terrible she felt for Chadwick and the rest of her old friends out there in the dark, endless woods, Sophie wouldn't be the one to help them. "I'm afraid I'm dean of a school just like you, Professor Dovey, entrusted with more than 100 students. I can't just abandon them," Sophie decided. "I don't care what your map says. Hester, Anadil, and Dot will do just fine on their own." The three witches blinked at each other as if they'd telepathically made a wish and had it granted. Professor Dovey tightened her silvery bun.
"Sophie, you might be a dean, but you're also a fourth-year student, which means I can change your quest just like you changed Hort's. And once a dean assigns your quest, you must accept it, or be sent to the Brig of Betrayers."
"Don't you threaten me, Clarissa," Sophie retorted, watching Dovey wince at her first name. "You can't tell me what to do. I know you want to get rid of me, given how fond of evil your good students are, and this gives you the perfect excuse."
"You think this is about you? I should have known. Every time it seems you've changed, I'm reminded how selfish you can be," said Professor Dovey. "Your first 3 years you trampled on students of both schools to further your own arrogant, often cowardly goals. You punished them, tormented them, betrayed them. And yet they forgave you, and even obeyed you as their dean in the remaining months of their third year. They showed you the loyalty you never once showed them. Now these same classmates are in peril and need your help, which means the story isn't about you anymore, Sophie. It's about them. But if you would like to make it about you, then think of it this way. This is no longer a tale about whether you will find fame or fortune or your perfect little happy ending. This is a tale about whether you are capable of growing from the snake of your own story into the hero of someone else's. That is your new quest. That is the tale the Storian is waiting to write."
Sophie went quiet, her emerald eyes fixed on the elder dean. A dark crimson spread into her cheeks, and for a moment she looked less like evil's leader and more like a chastened child.
"She's coming, isn't she?"
Hester mumbled, her demon making faces.
"Please don't tell me you can turn a person to chocolate,"
Anadil asked Dot. "I have enough trouble with lentil cakes, thank you," Dot nipped. Sophie wasn't listening, her focus drifting to the party uphill. "But who will take over as evil's dean?" she asked weakly.
"Professor Manley," said the elder dean, adding before Sophie could object, "and I suspect his unpopularity will only increase your status once you return.
if I return, you mean? Sophie corrected. She expected Professor Dovey to reassure her, but the dean said nothing.
And what about the new schoolmaster? Asked Hester. We spent the last 6 months combing the woods for someone who would best serve the school.
New schoolmaster? That was your quest? To find a schoolmaster?
Sophie asked, whirling to Professor Dovey.
You left the choosing of the one person who has control over you and me to them?
And I still would, Professor Dovey said. But that's not to say that part of their assignment is over. You may very well come across the right candidate on your new quest, girls, and if you do, I expect a full report so I can interview them myself.
This seemed to appease both the coven, who wanted to see the job through, and Sophie, who fully intended to supervise the schoolmaster's selection now that she was along for the trip.
In the meantime, I'll keep tabs on the Storian with the rest of the faculty, said Professor Dovey. Though, as Merlin pointed out, if there was one lesson in the tale of Sophie and Agatha, it's that the Storian does a rather remarkable job of protecting itself.
Speaking of Merlin, which Evers is he sending to be on our quest?
Hester asked.
It better not be Beatrix and her rancid minions, Sophie griped. And how do you expect us to travel? On foot? I'm famous now. The whole world knows my fairy tale. I can't be traipsing from kingdom to kingdom in a dirty dress.
The clocks in both castles tolled midnight, drowning her out, while Professor Dovey peered at the bay.
Merlin assured me his Everteam would be here by now. Do you see them?
Sophie and the witches exchanged glances as if the old dean had stayed up too long past her bedtime.
Wouldn't they be arriving at the south gate? Sophie said delicately.
Suddenly, a ripple burped at the midpoint of the bay, right in front of the schoolmaster's tower. The sound it made was low and croaky, like a dyspeptic toad's. Then more ripples formed, faster and faster, spewing bubbles of clear water and blue sludge into the sky, each burp more violent than the last, as if the bay was trying to expel something it had swallowed. Then, in one willful spurt, the hull of a ship popped through the surface, only upside down, with the rest of the ship buried beneath the bay. It took a final cacophonous belch to send the hull toppling over and turn the ship right side up, a glorious blue and gold billowing with creamy white sails and the name Igraine painted along the bow near a masthead statue of a young, dark-haired woman dangling a lantern over the sea. For a moment, as water and slime drained off the vessel and it propelled towards the shore, Sophie thought it must be a ghost ship, for there didn't seem to be a captain. But then she saw a shadowy figure at the prow in a dark leather jacket and cut-off breeches, hair tied up in a bandana. And from what she could see, he was sharp-jawed, fine-featured, and handsome. Yet, as the boat slid onto torchlit banks and stuttered to a stop, Sophie saw for the second time in one evening that the boy she'd been expecting was not a boy at all.
Agatha? She choked.
Her friend was already throwing a rope over the side of the ship and sliding down. The two girls dashed towards each other and collided in a breathless hug, falling into the bay. Sophie's white dress was slopped in sludge, but she didn't care. Gripping Agatha like she might never let go, both of them caught between giggles and tears. On the shore, Professor Dovey was dabbing her eyes, as were Dot and Anadil. each of who knew what it meant to have a best friend. Even Hester was biting her lip.
"I missed you, Aggie," Sophie whispered.
"Not as much as I missed you. They made Pollux give me wedding lessons," Agatha said breathlessly.
"That little weenie, in Camelot," Sophie squeaked, "giving wedding advice."
"A wedding you're now in charge of planning," said Agatha. Sophie burst into laughter.
"Good heavens, we have a lot to catch up on."
She kissed her dearest friend and nuzzled against her.
"But now that I have you, I'm not letting you go. Even if you didn't write me, even if I thought you'd forgotten all about me, I love you, Agatha. I always will."
Her friend held her close. "I love you too. And I never forgot about you, Sophie. I never could." Sophie hugged her tighter.
"I'm here!"
a voice shouted. The girls turned to see Hort bounding around the side of the bay, naked except for a tablecloth from the party wrapped around his waist.
"I tried to follow you, but then my man-wolf started shrinking, and it got really bad, and then it took me forever to find you guys, so, yeah."
He bent over, panting.
"What did I miss?"
He took one look at Professor Dovey and the three witches goggling at him, then at two girls embraced in the sand, gaping at him too, Sophie's red lipstick on Agatha's cheek.
"Not again!"
Hort gasped. Only the girls weren't looking at Hort at all. They were looking past him, at a tall silver tower rising out of the bay. An open window, lit by the moon. A sharp steel pen, sweeping ink across a page. The Storian. Writing. A new fairy tale had begun. Chapter 9. Hort. Who would want a hort?
"Come, girls, we need to see what the pen is writing before it turns the page,"
Professor Dovey said, leading the group towards Evil's castle.
"Once it moves on, it won't let us flip back."
Hort was desperate to take a bath and put pants on, but he couldn't let Agatha run off with Sophie unsupervised, so he followed them up the shore. Every time he was free of rivals for Sophie's attention, they always returned, more meddling than ever. Why couldn't these toads mind their own business or die like Rafal did? True, he'd had Sophie to himself these past 6 months, but most of that was spent waiting out her "I'm an independent woman" phase, which consisted of her doing a lot of yoga, reading poetry in her study, and hosting girls' nights in the common room. But after what he just saw at the party, it was clear Sophie was slobbering after boys again, and not just boys. Ever boys. Ugh. Did those preening stallions have any idea what it was like to be normal? Because that's what being a never was. Normal, as in you woke up with smelly armpits and you broke out in pimples if you ate too many fried pig's feet, and you had to slave in the groom room gym for every ounce of muscle, time that you would rather spend learning spells or catching lizards or doing something useful. But if you didn't waste half your day pumping Norse hammers and swinging kettlebells and doing one-handed push-ups, then you'd be a skinny, oily loser for the rest of your life. And yet, in the end, it didn't matter how much work Hort did to improve himself. He still couldn't find love. At least, not the love he wanted. Not Sophie. He thought about the anonymous fan letters he'd been getting these past few months.
Dear Hort, I don't know why you chase girls who don't appreciate you. There are girls like me who've read the tale of Sophie and Agatha and think you're the real hero. At first he thought they were from a reader in Sophie's old town, but then he'd noticed that the letters were written on school parchment, which meant Sophie was right all along. They were just a prank to embarrass him. Hort felt ashamed for getting suckered yet again. It was so obvious the letters were fakes. Who would want a Hort when there were Bodies and Lathans running around? That's what he resented most about Everboys. Girls liked them for their looks, when they'd done nothing to earn those looks. The stupid idiots were born like sculpted gods out of sheer dumb luck, the way other people are born with crooked faces or clubbed legs, and instead of being thankful or humble about this luck, they acted like they deserved it. But even if Sophie was smart enough to see through these arrogant gasbags, she still fell for them, like a mouse who couldn't tell the trap from the cheese. Why did he want her, then? Why care about a girl who couldn't see he was better than those soft-headed lumps? Why idolize someone who would rather kiss the hot blonde boy with the charm of a pineapple over a thinking, feeling boy like him? Maybe I'm broken, Hort thought to himself. Maybe he was drawn to mean girls the way a girl like Agatha was drawn to good boys. Then again, Agatha was about to marry Tedros, a boil on the backside of humanity. Whatever. The point was he should be free of Sophie by now. Instead, he was her employee. Hort had no business being professor of history in the first place, since he didn't know the slightest thing about history and was pretty sure his students knew it too, but they never complained, because he gave them high ranks and passed out candy every Friday. And he was also sure his students knew he was in love with Sophie, since any time she sat in on his class, they made fawning comments about his teaching, as if they'd collectively decided to be wingmen in helping him earn the dean's heart. It made him like his students more than he thought possible, and he'd convinced himself that his crusade to marry Sophie wasn't just for him anymore, but for all evil kind. Except now Agatha was back. Bug-eyed, skinny-legged, helmet-haired Agatha, who made Sophie smile the way he wished he could. Agatha, who had the gall to tell him last year that Sophie would never love him. Since then, all he'd wanted was to prove her wrong, to prove to himself, to his students, to whoever was sending those fake love letters, that a boy like Hort could finally get the girl. But now none of it would happen, because when Agatha was around, Sophie didn't even notice him, and he always ended up running after them in some wild goose chase like he was right now.
"Well, you two, slow down,"
he wheezed, tripping over his toga, his bare feet punished by the pebbly floor as he followed them into Evil's castle. "So Merlin set this whole thing up. That sly dog," Agatha was saying to Sophie while Hort scrambled to eavesdrop. "First, he mentions the Igraine. Then he chastises me for not talking to you. He did it all so I'd steal the ship and come here. I thought I'd be taking on this quest alone, while all the while he planned for us to do it together."
"But why a ship, Aggie?"
Sophie moaned, magically dissolving blue sludge off her and Agatha with her glowing pink finger.
"I despise boats. They smell like toilets, the beds are stiff, there's never any fresh vegetables, and it's impossible to do yoga without falling overboard any time there's a swell.
Wait until you see this ship, though. The Igraine magically steers on my command. It can turn invisible. It can fly. Throw on a bandana and a pair of breeches, and now you're Whiskey Woo, the pirate queen. Sophie grumped as they followed Dovey and the witches upstairs, bypassing the party in Evil Hall. The Igraine. Good lord. Sounds like a prehistoric bird, or a splitting headache. Well, if we're together, I suppose I'll muddle through. Speaking of which, where's the other Evers? Merlin said you'd have a crew.
Crew? Agatha said. No crew. I mean, Willem's on board, but he's been in his cabin seasick ever since we left.
Willem?
Sophie asked with keen interest. Hort scowled. He had enough boys at school to compete with, let alone boys lurking in boats.
Also, what kind of a name was Willem?
Sounded like the noise frogs made when they sucked down flies.
Hold on. No crew? Sophie asked. But Merlin told Dovey he was sending a team of Evers tonight to join me and the Coven. That together we'd be in charge of saving our classmates' failing quests.
Well, we could certainly use the help on board, Agatha mulled. Especially since we're overloaded with Nevers. Maybe Dovey can give us a couple of her best first years. Perhaps that's what Merlin wanted us to do for a crew.
Then why not just tell us as much? Sophie grouched. Why is everything a riddle with that old prat?
Because these are our quests, Sophie, not his, said Agatha.
I still think the man's a nosy, musty loon, said Sophie. But do tell me about Willem. Is he gorgeous and strong? A strapping swabby of the high seas?
Behind them, Hort went apoplectic red.
I don't think he's your type, Agatha chuckled.
Hort exhaled, relieved.
To be fair, no one thought Rafal was my type either, said Sophie as they reached the highest floor and followed Dovey and the witches onto an outdoor catwalk.
Two wolf guards patrolled the walk, which stretched between the highest floor of Evil's castle and the schoolmaster's tower. As she passed, Sophie gave the guards an imperious smile and flicked dust off the red and gold Sophie's Way sign, lit up and pointing towards the silver spire that divided the bay between good and evil.
Now, Aggie, for the most important question of all. What do we do about this wedding of yours?
Can't be worrying about a wedding when we have to save the woods. Agatha said. It would have been a challenge anyway. You'd have had to plan the whole wedding from here at school. Camelot's castle is already a mess, and Tedros doesn't want you there romping around and causing more upheaval.
I see, Sophie said archly. Afraid I might steal his crown?
Right. I think it's well established that you two should stay as far from each other as possible. We'll get someone else to plan the wedding.
Nonsense. I'll do it while we travel. I just need two assistants on board, a fleet of courier crows, and an unlimited budget.
Camelot is bankrupt, Sophie.
And naturally I'll bring Bogdan as one of my assistants, so perhaps we can include another Ever to balance out our crew. A handsome boy like Bodhi or Lathan?
Wedding!
Hort cried, interloping between the girls.
20 minutes ago you said you were done with Agatha's wedding, that you never wanted to think about her and Tedros again, that you were throwing your own party because you were totally over...
Sophie thrust out her glowing finger and zipped his mouth with a spell. Stunned, Hort tried to yell through sealed lips, to no avail.
One of Lesso's best hexes,
Sophie told Agatha. I've been reading her old spell books during my nightly baths. Agatha took a deep breath. Sorry I didn't write you all these months, Sophie, she said, nearing the schoolmaster's tower. So much has happened since I left school. The royal rot certainly agrees, Sophie replied. Sophie! Darling, you weren't writing me and I needed news of my best friends. You didn't expect me to read the Camelot Courier, did you? Nothing but propaganda. And the rot is any better. A tabloid that said I cursed Tedros to fall in love with me and plan to slit his throat on our wedding night once I'm officially queen? Sophie snickered. And here I was feeling guilty I hadn't written you, Agatha said. Sophie threw an arm around her. Well, it doesn't matter now, does it? We're together again, and this time without a prince in our hair as we head off on the biggest adventure of our lives. Hort was grinding his teeth so loudly that the two girls glanced at each other. Is he really still there? Sophie murmured. Poor little weasel, Agatha said, pointing her glowing gold finger and unzipping his mouth. Hort exploded at Sophie.
Adventure! Adventure! If you think you're going into the woods with her, then you have another thing coming. You reassigned my quest and made me a teacher, and I didn't complain because you made it sound like you'd be my girlfriend, and we'd go on dates and eat ice cream and kiss like normal couples do. And instead, you treat me like a servant, and now you're trying to abandon me at school and take skinny, stinky Bogdan. Are you kidding? Just because Agatha deserted her stupid boyfriend to go gallivanting around the woods doesn't mean you can. I spend every day teaching kids about elf wars and wizard summits and things I don't care a lick about to spend time with you. And you think you can leave? Kiss my big, blooming ass. I'll set that ship on fire if you even get close.
Sophie blinked at him, speechless. You know, sometimes I wonder what he sees in you, said Agatha. Sophie laughed and took her hands. Everything, darling. Everything. As the two girls continued towards the schoolmaster's tower, Hort watched them go. He knew what he saw in her. The same thing he'd always seen, no matter how badly she'd treated him. He saw a girl as soft and vulnerable as he was. If only she'd let herself feel it instead of distracting herself with the next best thing. Don't follow her, Hort begged himself.
Please. Don't follow her.
He followed. As he scrambled to keep up with the girls, Hort told himself it was only because he'd never entered the schoolmaster's tower before. But that wasn't the real reason, of course. The real reason was because the tower was now Sophie's private chamber, and he wanted to see the inside. The scaffolding shrouding the spire was dotted with sleeping stymphs, slumbering after a long day of renovations. Stymphs detested Hort, so he held his breath as he passed. Skirting between two more watchful wolf guards, he followed Dovey and the girls through a gap in the silky black scaffold. Don't act like it's a big deal, Hort thought as he climbed through the open window. Don't be creepy. But he was creepy. He was always creepy. Creepiness was an inalienable, undeniable part of his essential Hortness. His bare feet touched the carpet, and Hort snapped out of his thoughts.
Every inch of the floor of Sophie's chamber was blanketed in lush, white threads. So soft and deep they swallowed his feet like warm milk. His eyes roamed the sky-blue walls, studded with thousands of tiny silver balls like congealed drops of rain. The stone ceiling had been knocked out and replaced with a shallow aquarium filled with water that changed color every 10 seconds, and glittery floating glass flowers. In one corner, Sophie's king-sized bed was veiled in a gold lace canopy, and beyond it, he could see inside the all-mirrored bathroom, teeming with vials and bottles of potions and creams. Nearby was a walk-in closet, with racks of magically suspended dresses organized by color and theme, and presided over by a grim-faced black mongoose with the name Boubachois on a tag around his neck, who was in the process of steaming one of Sophie's kimonos.
Crikey, all I got in my closet is moths and soggy breeches,
Hort murmured. He turned, expecting Dovey and the witches to be as surprised by all this as he was, but the six of them were circled around the Storian as it wrote in a storybook, its gold-hued cover spread open on the white stone table. Hort moved in closer and saw the pen's sharp nib sweeping colors across a painting of a boy lying by a lake, his eyes closed. Blood leaked from a wound in the boy's ribs, framing him in a crimson puddle. Hort and Agatha looked up at Professor Dovey, but neither she nor the witches nor Sophie seemed as frozen with shock.
Chattick, Agatha rasped. He's...
We don't know who killed him or why, Sophie said softly, studying the storybook. But if this is right, his body is by the lake that took us to Guinevere and Lancelot's safe house.
That's where the Lady of the Lake lives, Hester added. How did Chadwick get through her castle's gates? Maybe there's a part of the story we're missing.
Quickly, Hester slipped her fingernail under the storybook's page to see the pages that came before. The Storian scorched red with fury and stabbed at her finger. Hester withdrew it before it impaled her.
It's the first page.
What? Sophie blurted. Once upon a time a handsome boy died.
Under other circumstances, I'd be enthralled, said Annadil.
This proves that Chadwick was on to something, said Professor Dovey, giving her a look. His death is part of a larger story, just as Merlin thought.
Hort could see Agatha staring at the storybook, tears on her cheeks. Even though Agatha was a nagging goat, the fact she was crying made Hort's eyes mist up, too. Chadwick had been a boy at school, just like him. A boy who'd been on a quest in the endless woods and had now died for it. And here was Hort, a spineless sap confined to the castle because he'd given up his real quest to chase a girl. Guilt and determination flushed through him, two crisscrossing rivers. Like Chadwick, Hort's own father had been killed on a quest, a lifelong mission to serve Captain Hook in the fight against Peter Pan. Hort had come to the school for evil, to be better than his father. But what would his father think of him now? Still at school, pretending to be a teacher, puttering after someone who wouldn't give him the time of day. For the first time, he felt the death grip Sophie had on his soul weaken. This wasn't about her anymore. This was about making something of his life, Even Peter Pan had learned to grow up. Hort gazed out the window at the Igraine in Evil's Harbor, sails flapping in the wind. Wherever that ship was going, he would be on it. Suddenly the girls tensed all at once and huddled closer to the storybook.
"What is it?"
he asked. But now he saw for himself. The Storian was writing its first words of the story. Beneath the painting of Chaddock's body, the pen etched its bold, beautiful script. Once upon a time, a snake made its way into the woods. Its plan was simple. Take down the lion. The Storian turned the page and began to paint once more.
A snake? Hester asked, baffled. A lion?
Annadil echoed. So this is about, disgruntled animals? Dot said. No, Agatha replied, peering at the storybook. It's not about animals at all. Everyone watched her, waiting for her to elaborate.
Then what's it about?
Hort prodded. Agatha raised her eyes. It's about getting to Avalon now. There was panic in her face, as if she'd put a puzzle together the rest of them hadn't. How soon can you leave? Professor Dovey pressed. We need food and weapons, said Agatha.
I'll make sure you have both, said the Dean. Aggie, what is it?
Sophie asked, glancing between them. But the Storian had finished its second painting now, a magnificent rendering of the twin-sailed Igraine sinking back under Halfway Bay, with Agatha at the stern commanding the ship onwards. The pen wrote beneath. Soon, a team of students from the School for Good and Evil set out to find the snake, led by two best friends, Sophie and Agatha, along with a crew of three witches, an altar boy named Willem, and a first-year never named Bogdan. The Storian halted.
What about me?
Hort protested. But no one was paying the slightest attention because Professor Dovey was rounding up the girls towards the window.
Come, there's provisions in the kitchen and weapons in the armory. Boubichois!
Sophie yelped at her startled mongoose.
Start packing my suitcase.
Wait a second,
Hort piped up.
You'll need food and water for a week before you can reload in the Everlands. Dovey was saying. Enough clothes for 2 months, Boubichois.
Sophie hollered over her.
I'll send Bogdan to fetch the luggage.
I said, wait a second.
Hort bellowed. Six pairs of eyes went to him.
Look,
he said. They followed his gaze to the long white table. The Storian was writing again. There was one more member of their crew, however. Someone they hadn't expected. Someone who they'd need on their dangerous quest. Hort raised his fist.
See? See? I told you, it saved the best for...
Someone named Nicola. Nicola? Agatha said, mystified. Everyone stared at the page.
Who in tarnation is Nicola?
Hort barked. But only Dovey and Sophie seemed to know, for they both eyed each other with strange looks before Sophie slowly turned to Agatha. Well, darling, it seems we've found the missing ever for your team. Chapter 10. Nicola. The perks of being a reader.
Sophie might be a dean, but that didn't mean Nicola had respect for the girl or would join her ranks of fawning students. For one thing, she'd met Sophie back when they lived in Gavaldon, but Sophie was acting as if she'd never seen Nicola in her life. For another, Nicola had read The Tale of Sophie and Agatha and thought Sophie was a Class A brat. And then, on Nicola's first day, Sophie had blamed her for caving in a classroom when it wasn't her fault at all. For these reasons, and more, she'd been giving Sophie hostile looks ever since she got to school 2 weeks ago, and Sophie had been giving them right back. So imagine Nicola's surprise when it was Sophie herself who barged into her room tonight and dragged her onto this boat, helped by Hester, Dot, and Annadil, three witches she'd only seen in a storybook. No one told her why. They'd just acted like she was their prisoner and gave her 30 seconds to pack before they flung her aboard and dumped her in the worst room. She didn't even know who else was on the crew, since no one had bothered to come check on her once they'd set sail. It hurt her feelings, to be honest. Hester was one of her favourite characters in The Tale of Sophie and Agatha, and being treated like a stray dog by your favourite characters is worse than never meeting them at all. Even Dot, who seemed so jolly and sweet on the page, hadn't managed a proper hello. "I should have known," she thought. "Girls like me are always left out of fairy tales." Nicola steeled herself. Well, if this crew couldn't show her the most basic manners, then she wasn't going to make an effort either. Instead, she would handle them the way she'd handled rude customers at Parr's Pub in Gavaldon, with grace, dignity, and pity for their poor souls. Thunder blasted outside, and a slash of lightning lit up her window. Nicola unpacked her toothbrush, soap, and comb in her tiny bathroom. The boat had been swerving and lurching through this storm for the past hour. Whoever was steering had no idea what they were doing. "Man the sails!" Agatha cried, soaked to the bone as she gripped the captain's wheel. Nicola snuck closer to the galley door so she could peer through the crack and survey the whole deck. Lightning ripped through a sail, and the Igraine lurched off course, rain flooding over the rails. The storm had exploded only a few hours after they left, caging them into whirling winds they couldn't escape. Hester and the witches were siphoning water off the deck using their finger glows.
"Lady of the Lake controls these waters. Should be giving us easy passage," Hester was shouting at Annadil and Dot. Meanwhile, Nicola's classmate, Bogdan, was clutching a red-haired boy as he puked overboard. Sophie was crawling on all fours up the deck, and another boy was batting down the hatches, which kept coming loose.
"Hort!" Nicola gasped, recognizing him. Her whole body went hot. Wind slammed against the boat, spinning it like a pinwheel, knocking Sophie into a railing. The broken sail flapped over her, lashing against the mast. A huge shard of wood snapped under the rogue sail and came shearing down, about to spear the deck. Instantly, Dot turned the shard into chocolate chips, which scattered into the rain. Hester's demon flew off her neck and hoisted up the heavy sail. Annadil's three rats secured its ropes, all the while catching chocolate in their mouths.
"What did I say about boats?"
Sophie mewled, makeup smeared, soggy hair caught around her neck like a noose. Blown side to side, she scooted on her stomach up the steps to the captain's level.
"The wind is sending us everywhere but Avalon,"
Agatha growled, wrangling the wheel. "We should be there by now."
You said the ship listens to you.
Sophie squawked behind her. The ship, not the weather. The faster I tell it to go, the more the wind hits us. Sophie lunged off the top step and grabbed hold of Agatha's ankle.
Isn't it a magic ship? Make it fly or turn invisible.
What good is being invisible in a storm or flying higher into it? Agatha said, squinting into the rain.
We must be 50 miles off course.
There were clearer skies to the east, which would give them a chance to regroup. She just needed to steer the boat out of this wind gauge.
Sail east!
She shouted at the wheel. The Igraine bounded eastwards, but bashed into headwinds, making it swing back and forth like one of those sickening pirate ship rides at the Gavaldon Fair. Sophie lost grip of Agatha's shoe and went rolling down the stairs.
Agatha!
She shrieked, hanging off the staircase banister. Hort ran to save her, but tripped and plunged down a hatch. Bogdan was now retching alongside the red-haired boy, while the witches tumbled across the deck like marbles. As the ship bobbed, water surged over the rail. The Igraine started to sink. "Mind if I help?" a voice said behind Agatha. Agatha turned to see a short, buxom black girl, her age, leaning against a rail, arms folded. She had a cat-like face with thin eyes and sloping brows, along with springy black curls, immune to the rain, and a pink first-year's-ever uniform, at odds with her cold expression.
"Nicola?" Agatha said, shouting over the storm. "That's your name, isn't it?" "And yours is Agatha, though the Agatha I've read about would have come and said hello. So maybe that's not your name after all,"
Nicola replied. Agatha winced, but Nicola didn't give her a chance to respond.
"Steer like it's a riptide. The wheel's spinning left because you're trying to go right. If you want to go right, turn the ship left."
"Aggie, help!"
Sophie howled below, a seagull on her head. Nicola narrowed her eyes. "Seagulls love the smell of hot decay. Wonder what that says about your friend." She turned to find Agatha gaping at her.
"I just told you how to get us out of this storm," Nicola said.
Agatha shook her head. "Sailing in the opposite direction doesn't make sense." Nicola glared harder.
"Listen. I may be a first-year reader who no one on this boat cares about, but that also means I've read your fairy tale and know you're a smart girl. Smart enough to realize you've been trying to get out of this storm for the past hour and have instead put us on the verge of a very watery death."
Another tidal wave detonated onto the deck, drenching Agatha.
"One more, and we'll get to see who can hold their breath the longest," said Nicola.
Agatha swiveled towards the wheel.
"Sail west!"
she commanded. The Igraine pivoted smoothly to the west for just a moment. Then the current took over, counterposing the ship east. The wooden girl on the masthead swept her lantern towards the dawn-lit clearing. In a single move, the boat broke free of the wind trap and glided towards Avalon. Sophie dropped like a stone to the deck, her gown blown over her head like a broken umbrella. The rest of the crew peeked up, no longer thrashing or scrambling or retching. All of their eyes honed in on the new girl, who'd just saved their necks. Sophie was the only one who didn't smile at her. Nicola sauntered towards the galley in her sheepskin boots.
"Is breakfast ready, or should I take care of that too?"
"Wait. If you're a reader, How do you know how to do that? Agatha called out behind her.